back to the bin.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Back to the Bins. I'm Paul Spataro, and I am here today by special request. And that request came, you know, being the big Odd Couple fan I am, I expect that request came from his wife, and you see the frowns. that request came from my friend Chris Eberle, who wanted to cover Batman Year One.
Can two divorced men share an apartment without driving each other crazy?
My favorite show of all time.
Great show.
So we have the group today, and today with us, obviously, is Chris Eberle, as I just said. We also have Sean Whalen, Shane Kelly, and Adam Murdo. So it's I think I've come to call you the podcasting friends somehow, because we didn't have an official title any longer. So we're going with that. I'm going to hand the stage over to Chris in just a moment, but I'm just going to hit on quickly. I am familiar with Year One. I've been familiar with it for years, but until you said, let's do this, I don't think I ever sat down and read it from beginning to end.
Wow.
I've read it before. I've read pieces before, certainly, but I don't think I've ever sat down and read all four issues in a row, which for the sake of continuity here, it starts in Batman issue 404 from February of 1987 and runs to issue 407. I'll talk more about my impressions of it as we go on, but for the time being, again, I'm going to hand the microphone over to Chris to take us through this journey.
Well, Paul, thanks again for having us all on. It's great to be with all of you. It's been a little while, like you said. This is a book I've always wanted to talk about, and in all the years I've done comic podcasting, if just for whatever reason, it's just never come up as the exclusive sort of purview of an episode. So I just thought, you know what, I haven't podcasted in a while and I really miss everybody. So let's talk about Batman Year One. And Paul, you were gracious enough to host this. And again, I really appreciate it. I think for me, the reason why I want to talk about this, well, first of all, it's by my favorite creative team in comics, because it's the team that did Daredevil Born Again, yeah. Frank Miller and David Mazzucchelli. So that's number one. Number two, for me, this is the Batman story that I think more than any other really captures Batman as a mythic figure. And I think that whenever I reread this book, and I just reread it again, and I've read it hundreds of times in my life, because I have to show my old 1988 trade that I first, because I wasn't reading Batman in 86 and 87 in monthly form. So I read it in the trade that came out shortly thereafter. And just rereading this book again, I think it just goes right to the essence of what makes the character who he is, not just Batman, but also the world around him. Gotham is very much a character in this book. Of course, the whole book is narrated primarily through Commissioner Gordon's perspective, and it just elevates how important he is to this entire mythos as well. But when we just think about what makes Batman such an utterly compelling, you know, character in comics and the world of, you know, sort of pulp and everything else that's gone on. I mean, I think he was voted best character of the 20th century. I think I want to say that when they
make like the whole comic like
characters.
That.
I think what makes the character so riveting to people, and he's obviously made such an imprint on multimedia. I mean, it's from 1939 forward. I mean, there was a Batman serial in the 1940s, for example, with like the droopy ears on the helmet. But
he even showed up in Superman radio dramas.
That's right.
Back in the early days.
But I think whether you're thinking about, you know, the fun, campy Adam West Batman, or, you know, the Batman of the films, or the many different iterations of the character in the comics, I think it all goes back to what's really captured in this story, which I think really builds upon the early like pulp crime noir aspects of the character, and the early appearances when he was actually killing people, and you know, all that whole feel to the character. I think it is Miller and Mazzucchelli go right to the heart of that in this book. This is very much a noir, and of course Miller is, that's one of his major influences in all the work he's done. When we did our Daredevil discussions, Sean, Paul and I recently, we talked about that. I think it's very much in here, especially Gordon's narration, which is right out of a a crime noir novel.
Yeah,
essentially. But I won't ramble on too much initially, just that this is, to me, this book is everything that Batman is, what makes Batman so compelling, what makes Batman so frightening. And also the fact that you have both the seedy side of the world, like when he's doing reconnaissance in the slums, and then you also have the elements that are just essentially myth, the bat crashing through the window and settling on the bust of his father's head, and, you know, the moment of sort of like spiritual communion with that animal. And the story, this is one of those rare books that still gives me chills in certain scenes when I read it. So, and I was mentioning this to Shane a while ago. Dan Jurgens and Mike Perkins did a Treasury size story, Batman First Night. And then the second part, Batman Second Night, has just come out, which goes right to the early adventures when he's wearing the purple gloves. And if you guys haven't read those, Shane, I think I lent you the first one, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, the first series.
Yeah. It's very much in the same sort of vein as Batman Year One in terms of the feel, the tone, the challenges he's facing. And I just read the first part of Second Night, which just came out, which was outstanding. So I'm really excited to talk about, you know, sort of what I guess you could say this version of Batman, or at least to me, this is the foundational Batman, essentially.
I think I tend to agree with you. I like that description you just gave, the foundational Batman. But I think the impression I walked away from with this full reading of it was it almost felt more to me to be Commissioner Gordon Year One than Batman Year One.
In a lot of ways, yeah.
Oh, I think that's I completely agree. I mean, I completely agree with that, Paul. I mean, it's as much Gordon's story as it is Batman / Bruce Wayne. Because so much of the story is through, I mean, there's some narration from Bruce as he's getting ready and what he's thinking about doing, but you're right. A lot of it is Gordon, and it's Gordon. What's great about his role in the story is, you know, right from the beginning, he's the stand-up cop, but he's also a human being. I mean, he gets involved in an adulterous affair. And you know, you see him wrestling with just the overwhelming, suffocating corruption of Gotham, and how can anyone stay upright and honorable in an environment like that. And you see him wrestling with that throughout the story. And it's really the presence of Batman, especially when he realized what Batman really is and what Batman represents, in a way I think saves Gordon, essentially. And it gives him the opportunity to be more of the cop that he really would like to be, even in a den of iniquity like Gotham. So I couldn't agree more.
And in some ways it's a two-way interchange between the two of them, because of the fact that Bruce is trying to figure out how this all works and who he can believe in the force. And Gordon's kind of like is one that gives him some hope that like there's actually people I can work with on the other side. Yeah. In a very, very corrupt police environment. I actually, one of the things that I noticed this time around more so, I agree with the idea that this can look primarily like a Gordon story, but I noticed a lot more the yin and the yang of Bruce feeling himself out and kind of, I liked the vulnerability of, he didn't just know how to be Batman.
No,
he wasn't just like gifted at all this. He made mistakes, was questioning himself when he was even ready to start doing it. And I liked even the first time he puts on the costume, it like wasn't,
oh, it's awesome.
It just was not clean at all. And I loved that. And
well, yeah, the scene, Sean, where first of all, he's trying to deal with his first encounter with Selina Kyle in the street, and she's having her way with him for a little bit, and then he's getting ganged up on. And then, of course, you said when he's dealing with the three hoodlums on the fire escape, Mazzucchelli is such a phenomenal artist, and the way you saw the same thing in Borgen, like the way he does a fight scene, and he takes you from one moment to the next. You know, the one thug jumping on the balcony, and Batman's like, "Oh, this guy's going to be trouble." He has training, and then you know he times it as the television or the air conditioner is falling to the street from panel to panel. And then everything's happening within those few seconds. He's one of the best artists in my view in the medium, period. Even though he hasn't done like a huge amount of work, but what he's done is so important. And I think it's captured in scenes like that.
I think the thing I would latch on to with Mazzucchelli isn't so much his artist renditions as his storytelling.
Oh, absolutely.
Like when you look at, you know, when you look at the individual panels, there are a great many artists out there that are probably superior to what he does in his renditions of people's faces or, you know, their body movements or, and all of that. But when you put it together, panel to panel to panel, page to page, his storytelling probably exceeds almost anybody. Yeah. I'm trying to think of who I would put at his level, and I'm coming up a little short. I'm sure there are some. I don't want to place him alone on that pedestal, but I'm having a tough time thinking of who does quite the same kind of work that he does.
Well, wait, go ahead, Sean. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
It's also the right kind of dirty.
Oh yeah.
You know, when you think of like things later that came later on, like Gotham Central and things like that, I think definitely harken back to
absolutely
what set up. Tonally on this one, I mean, it's got the right dirt under the nails in what it feels. And there's no other way to say this. At 87, I was in sophomore in high school. And Batman, I mean, we all take it for granted now that how cool Batman is. You know, he's Wolverine level cool and that type of thing as far as that type of character. He was not in this era. Comics were not something that like something you kind of hid that you talked about. In this era, this is when comics were making noise, and this was one of the pivotal Batman stories that was making noise and changing minds as far as what comics could be and what this character could be. And that's where I think this story is a true victory in the fact that foundationally, I think that it works on a lot of different levels. This story changed the game a lot during this time. As far as who you could talk to, I had friends of mine that were reading comics that wouldn't touch them a year before. And books like this were the ones that were opening that doorway.
Well, yeah, because Dark Knight came out right before this, if I remember correctly. This,
yeah.
And then, of course, you have, you know, all the same time period with Watchmen, V for Vendetta, Swamp Thing. Yeah. Any seasoned reader knows everything we're discussing here when it comes to those titles and their impact. But I couldn't agree more, Sean, in that, you know, I love all the versions of Batman. You know, Shane, we love the Super Friends Batman, who sounds like he's an old librarian. Or, you know, we've got, you know, we mentioned Adam West and like the fun, like the Neil Adams.
True Detective.
I just brain farted. I should be shot on the writer who worked with Neil Adams.
Denny O'Neill.
Thank you, Murd. Their 70s work, which is so vitally important. I mean, there's so much to go back to. But what resonates with me so much with this is that, like you guys are saying, it's extremely grimy. I mean, except when he goes to, you know, the manor, which is obviously totally removed from the city. But even that has the subterranean tunnels and the cave. And, you know, it's like anywhere you go, you can't escape. It's almost like Gotham is like this metastasizing, like inky, like sludgy disease spreading out from the city and just corroding everything around it. And the fact that you need people like Gordon and Bruce as Batman to descend into that and somehow retain their nobility while they're doing that is really at the core of what makes this so great. Because, like, kind of to go back to what Sean was saying, and I remember our good friend Matt has always said this too, like, you know, Batman, it could be a real person.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, you have to have phenomenal mania and fanaticism and training and money and all these things, but there's something about him that I think that's why I think he stands out among all the other famous, you know, iconic characters in like quote superhero comics, because he's not really a superhero in the traditional sense, is just the dedication. And you see that in this story, like when he's practicing and he smashes the tree trunk with his kick, and he's like obsessing, like he still hasn't figured exactly what is my end going to be, like what's going to be my angle for all of this. And that's where the myth comes in, with the bat and, you know, grabbing the little bell to summon Alfred. And that's when I start to get chills, because now this is something that's greater than just, you know, some vigilante, essentially. And I think about, go ahead. I didn't mean to cut you off there, please. No.
Even though Dark Knight Returns came out just before this, I think Year One really grounded him for a modern age.
Oh, absolutely.
And took, as great as the 70s were with a lot of his detective work and Ra's al Ghul and all that, that this really turned a corner for him going forward. And I think without this, you don't get 1989 Batman either.
Oh, in the same way. You don't get 89 Batman. You definitely don't get the Nolan films, which take whole scenes from the story.
And I would even say going along with Batman, with Bruce Wayne in this making mistakes, not knowing everything, that's something that I absolutely loved about the newest Batman movie, was that he didn't know everything. He did miss some things as he was only in his second year or so in this. I just thought that aspect of that movie was enthralling to me.
I've gone on and on and on. People are really sick of hearing how I don't like when they show Batman as infallible. Because if he's infallible, then he's not somebody you're going to relate to. He's not somebody who you're going to sit there and say, wow, you know, that's what I would do if I was a millionaire orphan. But, you know, I don't like the Batman that when he faces off against Superman, 9 out of 10 times he wins the fight. I don't like that because it's Superman. Superman could fly, you know, 200 feet above and just use his eyes to take Batman out. He doesn't actually have to engage him in hand-to-hand combat. So I like, as you mentioned, Chris, in this story, when he's fallible, when he's learning, when he makes a mistake, or Shane, you know, when you talked about in the movie that he's not perfect yet. I don't ever want him to be perfect. I want him to be somebody who struggles to be more than a normal person, and somebody who is, you know, known for his detective skills and puts things together the way Sherlock Holmes would, not that he just stumbles across stuff.
Oh yeah, yeah. But I can at least appreciate when he gets to a level of like Grant Morrison JLA time frame, and he does have contingency plans for everybody. He still can make a mistake. It's very rare. He does have everybody's Achilles heel, so to speak. So I don't mind when he beats Superman.
Didn't Morrison's story have Ra's al Ghul take advantage of the fact that he had all these backup contingency plans?
That's a classic JLA Tower story.
And that's where he's fallible.
Yeah.
Yes,
because he thought he had everything perfectly, but still, still screwed something up. But I can at least appreciate when you get to when Batman matures through his career and gets to that level of knowing how to stop everybody if need be, but he still can screw up.
Yeah, that's what I want. I don't want him to be, you know, me. I want him to be somebody who I would strive to be.
Yeah.
Murd, what are your initial thoughts, brother?
This is I had planned to be mostly a respectful listener in this episode and just allow the more seasoned and knowledgeable Millerologists in the room to just.
That's why I'm asking, because I know you're not a huge Miller fan. So.
It's true. It's true. But I will say this. This, of those canonical Miller texts to which I've been exposed, this is my favorite, far and away. And I would rank it in probably my top 10 favorite Batman stories that I've read. It's not my first time reading it, I'm happy to say. I remember clearly the first time I ever read it was in early spring of 2017, when our friend Pants and I were in Chicago for C2E2. And just opening it up to that opening scene with Commissioner Gordon rattling and clanking his way into the city on an L train. It was just a perfect fit for the environment, for just the raw cold of early spring in Chicago and where L trains are bound. So it's just a good confluence of reading environment and reading text. And it's left an impression on me. So here I am revisiting it, 8 years later, from the relative comfort of, early fall in Stone Harbor. And it's still impactful, no less. So it's, I enjoy the relative restraint of Miller's creative sensibilities here. The fact that he's working with a collaborator who is not himself. He's working with somebody who's a little more grounded as an artist. I think it lets him pull back a little bit on what would otherwise be his excessive tendencies. And I'm just really savoring just the noirish pulpy flavor of the character's narration. And ordinarily, this is the time when I brandish a sheath of faded four-color newsprint here, my single issues of the story. But now this one I actually have in trade, this hardcover edition, which came packaged with both DVD and Blu-ray editions, discs, of the animated movie they made back in 2011, which I'm sure we'll touch on eventually.
Oh, yes.
And having watched that just last night, you really appreciate what Miller's narrative voices, the getting deep into the seamy inner thoughts of Gordon and Bruce Wayne, what they bring to the story, because a lot of that is streamlined out in the animated version. So his prose is very enjoyable here, and Mazzucchelli, as Chris has pointed out, is a very gifted cartoonist, and the art he brings, it's simplified, and it's the forms and shapes are streamlined, but you still get that texture, that urban grit that's been mentioned already tonight. He does make Gotham City live. He makes these characters live as both real people, but also never losing sight of, he has a pretty strong sense of the basal absurdity of the superhero genre. And he's keenly aware of that, because, you know, they're trying to bring us a more down to earth, reality grounded bat. Like, what would happen if somebody tried to be Batman in a more realistic world than what we'd seen in DC Comics to that time? But at the same time, as Mazzucchelli realizes that you can't make it too realistic, because then things start to fall apart. Let me just go ahead and read a quote from him, actually, because at the back of this hardcover that I have here, there is a kind of a graphic memoir in comic strip form from Mazzucchelli, relating in brief his experiences with the character and also his experience with collaborating with Miller on this story. He says this: Frank wrote The Dark Knight in a fortissimo operatic mode, but he recognized that my strengths as an artist were more attuned to the mundane. True enough. So with Year One, we sought to craft a credible Batman grounded in a world we recognize. But did we go too far? Once a depiction veers toward realism, each new detail releases a torrent of questions that exposes the absurdity at the heart of the genre. And accompanying that observation, there's a little sketch of Batmite. The more quote-unquote realistic superheroes become, the less believable they are. It's a delicate balance. But this much I know. Superheroes are real when they're drawn in ink. That's just his last thought on the subject. There's that tightrope he has to walk between, you know, the gritty realism they're going for, and you don't want to puncture, you know, the magical thinking, fantastic bubble that surround the superheroes as a genre. So you've got this Batman who's trying to break in as a vigilante in this gritty urban hellscape. At the same time, staring us at the face, he's wearing those blue trunks, which are a detail that, if you really wanted to make this thing more realistic, probably would have been omitted. And I'm very happy that it wasn't. Mm-hmm. So it's a great tone. I've always been a fan of comics that take a look at portray the DIY vigilante. And this one does that here with a well-established and high-powered franchise character. So just keeps it right between, you know, the realistic and the fantastic, like the sublime and the ridiculous, I guess you could say.
You know, Murd, first of all, I'm really glad you're here. And number two, Professor Murd's office hours are now open. Outstanding work, my friend.
I was paying attention to that quote, which I found to be fascinating, and I found it to be very thought-provoking as far as the balance between the fantastical and, he used the word mundane, and I, you know, being the wordsmith that you are, Adam, I'm thinking you might be able to do better on that, because mundane, to me, the connotation is boring. And I don't think there's anything about this that's boring. I think what he's saying is, you know, fantastical and then more grounded or earthbound.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. As opposed mundane to mundane actually comes from a Latin word that means earth. So, yeah, earthbound.
And there you go. See, that's why I said, that's why I was asking.
Etymology for you, Paul.
but it you know, it is very thought-provoking, because I've actually found myself in the last, say, year or so, I'm finding a lot of movies on TCM that I never saw, that I've heard about, and I'm finding myself drawn a lot towards film noir kind of movies that I hadn't seen before. And I mean, I've always loved them, but now I'm seeing more of them than I had, and I'm just becoming more adept at just watching them, following them, enjoying them. And this definitely has that film noir feeling. Like, you could easily see this made in the 1940s or 50s in black and white, and just, you know, you could see this on the screen with, I'm trying to think of who I'd have starring as Bruce Wayne. Probably more key would be whoever you'd have as Commissioner Gordon. Maybe a young Spencer Tracy or something. I don't know. Mm-hmm. But it, you know, that's the feel I got when I was reading this, was the film noir feel. And that's where, you know, we go with that earthy or earthbound, as opposed to, like I said, I think while the original definition of mundane might be earthbound, I think it's come to mean boring over the years. And that's where I don't like the use of it in to describe this, because I don't think there's anything about his artwork that's boring. I think it just gives a tone to it that I just really enjoyed very, very much.
Well, Paul, no, I'm sorry. Go ahead. Go ahead, please.
No, go ahead. I'm going to say something else about noir stuff.
I was going to. You go first, brother.
So, Paul, if you like noir films, I can't recommend enough seeking out old-time radio shows on Sirius XM and listening to, like, Philip Marlowe or Johnny Dollar from the 40s and 50s. I would be tempted to put Bob Bailey, who has a very noirish detective voice, into that role sometimes. He might be a good Jim Gordon, but he could have also been a pretty good Bruce Wayne. But I thoroughly enjoy those whenever I can listen to them.
I will seek those out on your recommendation. I'll let you know how I make out with them.
So what I was going to say to piggyback on both Murd and Paul's points about the noir is that, like, if you just open to the first page, you know, January 4, and just Gordon's initial thoughts, Gotham City, maybe it's all I deserve now. Maybe it's just my time in hell.
Yeah.
And that is, I mean, Miller, I mean, he's clearly read, and we talked about this in our Daredevil discussion, Paul and Sean and I had, is that, you know, he's read Dashiell Hammett, he's read Raymond Chandler, etc., and he's seen these films like Maltese Falcon and there's so many others. And it's just seeping into these pages. And I also want to comment, Richmond Lewis's coloring in this story is vital to maintain that feel, because, here. You know, there's elements of it that are just washed out and gray, and like Murd mentioned, like the train, and like when he's sitting in that second panel in the train car, it's congested, it's claustrophobic. Everybody else is just gray and just almost lifeless, because the city's just sucking everything out of them. And then you see Gordon there, you know, a woman is nursing a child right next to the baby's, no doubt, you know, screaming. And you just feel off that page just how miserable this environment is that he's entering. And then the contrast of Bruce Wayne arriving, you know, in a very 80s type leather jacket, and, you know, sauntering into the airport. But again, everybody around him is gray too. The reporters who are trying to get his attention. So the coloring in this book, like when Flass attacks, and Flass and his cronies attack Gordon with the bats, and they make the color. And again, Mazzucchelli's inking himself as well, which is really another reason why this pops so much, I would imagine. But they make everything like blood red as he's being beaten. This is masterful stuff. I mean, and with great noir like this, this could be any time. Like this story, the way, like it could be now, it could be 50 years ago. I mean, because, you know, they don't. I mean, there's certain technologies that you don't see, but who cares? You know, cell phones have done enough damage to our society. So this is timeless. This works. I think you give this book to anyone back in 1986 or right now, and I think it's going to have the same impact. And that's the mark of these creators. Or, you know, this is Miller. He's at the top of his heyday in the mid to late 80s when everything he was doing was just having a dramatic impact on the comic book medium. So
I'm looking over issue one, or the first issue, and thinking about my casting the film noir of, you know, 70 years ago. Look at Bruce Wayne on page three when the first close up of him there. Tell me that Gregory Peck, a young Gregory Peck, is not the character model.
Yeah. Right on. Oh, you're right on. Wow, right on. Oh,
so that's my casting right there, just based on Mazzucchelli's art.
It wouldn't surprise me if he used Gregory Peck as a model for that panel.
Sure.
I think he did.
Well, yeah. I don't even think it's just that panel, because you go to the next page and look at the bottom.
You mean when he first sees Wayne Manor?
Yeah.
Yeah, that is Gregory Peck.
I have to.
Excuse me, Shane, but this is coming right out of my hardcover. One of the bonus materials at the end are some preliminary sketches that Mazzucchelli did, complete with his notes. My first rendering of Year One Batman, used for a DC House ad. Note the bat-like ears. And below, sketches of Bruce Wayne after photos of Gregory Peck.
Oh, there we go. Okay. I swear to you, I never saw that.
Bro, you were clutch with that deluxe edition. Well done, brother.
I don't usually go for the trade, but every once in a while it pays off.
Yeah.
You know, I just assumed that this one was sitting in your unread pile from 1987 to 2017, and that you finally got around to reading it.
I think as we're looking at these pages we were just discussing, Gordon's narrative, as we've already touched upon, is so central to the whole tone of this book.
Oh, yeah.
And you feel, A, how incredibly tough he is, number one. Like, this is not a guy who's gonna be, you know, put off easily, but also that he's descending into an environment that is so overwhelmingly toxic and corrupt, and you wonder, how is he going to get through this? I mean, Flass, he says, you know, Flass has Green Beret training. I haven't taken down a Green Beret in a long time. Like, stuff. I mean, you realize how tough and experienced Gordon is, but
yeah.
Man, how's he going to get through this? The next page where they show Bruce kneeling before the gravestone. I mean, how many times we've seen Bruce Wayne before the gravestones of his parents? But the way Mazzucchelli renders it, it's just the white background and just a gray black tone of Bruce, and it's riveting artwork.
And it's almost as if it's a placeholder the way it's in there. It's not actually part of the narrative at that moment. It's just, you know, we have Gordon, we have a little interlude with that, and then we go on with the story from there.
And then we go to February in the first issue and Bruce's thoughts. And what I like about the way they establish with Bruce's narrative is that he's a soldier. Like, the way he's describing what he's going to be doing, the way he's thinking about it, mm-hmm. you know, he's a strategist. He's analyzing, you know, what he needs to do, what he has to do, what he's trying to figure out, or when he's putting the fake scar in his face the next page and he's getting ready to go out into the
enemy camp.
The slums of Gotham. What's that word?
To the enemy camp.
The enemy, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. So remember, it's the war on crime, mm-hmm. right? And that's what he's initiating. What do you think of the first of the introduction of Selina Kyle, by the way, the way she's rendered in this story?
It's a study in world building.
Go for it.
And where I'm going with that is, if you take a look at the pages, it's funny, we talked about in the first page how, like, the anybody that was an extra in it was kind of gray. And they didn't like have any kind of background, but you start flipping through the pages, color starts coming into this.
Yep.
And we start fleshing out more than just Bruce and Jim Gordon. We're mm-hmm. fleshing out Flash. We're fleshing out Loeb. We're now getting to Selina and Holly. And these are characters. Now we've got a Gotham that is a living, thriving world. What Gordon and Bruce are responding to is being fleshed out for us, where this isn't something that we're just dealing with their narrative. We're actually seeing the world that they're responding to. And Selina's a great example of that. She's kind of like, she's obviously very seasoned in Gotham. She's like, I'm staying out of all this until what happens to Holly.
Right.
And I loved that introduction to her, as far as she knows how to play the game. She plays it very well. You see it in her interactions and what was going on, everything leading up to that. She is definitely a survivor. Until somebody who she loves gets hurt and she leaps on in. We learn a lot about this Selina here. And there was a mini series that came out of this, which just showed how much of a powerful character she became in this, that she actually carried her own mini series after.
Which mini series was this?
There was a Catwoman mini series.
I don't think I've read that one.
Yeah.
Was it a year one? Also,
no, I don't think it was.
Wasn't called Year One. It was something Catwoman, and I'll look it up. You know, while we're chatting here, but
see, the problem for me, mm-hmm. and this is purely a Paul problem. It's not truly a critique of the book. Is I have this romantic streak in me when I'm reading books, so I want Selina Kyle to be the love interest for Bruce Wayne, and for Batman. So I want her to be.
Well, she will be eventually, Paul.
I know, but I want her to be more pure than what she is here. If she's got to be a prostitute, I want her to be Julia Roberts in Pretty Woman. I don't want her to be a down and dirty prostitute. You know. So, and that's, again, it's a Paul problem. It's the romantic in me that I want her to be, like I said, this shining star for him to be. What, you know, to attain or to attain a relationship with, however you want to call it. And that's wrong, because I can, you know, I guess it's a sexist attitude that unintentionally so, but that, you know, the women have to be pure, but the men don't. That's not really fair. But my romantic image of Selina Kyle as Batman's love interest has her be a little less down and dirty than we get here.
We don't know her like this very often. I mean, we only see her when she has been the criminal, stolen the goods, evoked this way of manipulating men to get her way in a very beautiful way, as well as being the cat burglar.
I think the definitive Catwoman run is the Ed Brubaker period. Mm-hmm. I mean, that captures this whole backstory, really, and the consequences of that life, but also her attraction to Batman / Bruce Wayne as well. I mean, if you have not read the Ed Brubaker Catwoman, that is mandatory reading. Go ahead, Sean.
It was a 4-issue miniseries called Catwoman. It actually came out in 89.
And
it was meant to be a companion piece to this. Mindy Newell was the writer at the time, and it was collected as Catwoman, her sister's keeper.
Right, I had that title in mind. That's where we discover that Catwoman, like Daredevil, has a nun in the family. She's got a sister who is a sister.
Paul, you made me think of something really interesting, though, which is that, because you're talking about the idea of purity, right? So I think what's so powerful about the story is that no one in this story is pure. I mean, Gordon is obviously a heroic figure, but he has a fall from grace in his private life. Mm-hmm. And, you know,
which, to be honest, I don't care for that either. But it's just, you know, again, it's just because I want to put these people on a pedestal and they're not letting me.
See that? I understand that. I think we're just coming from different camps of when it comes to what we like. Like, I prefer in most cases, seeing heroes with feats of clay. I just think that's more interesting.
Oh, no, you're 100% right.
No, it's not a matter of being right or wrong. That's all.
No, but you're right in my mind, because if you make Commissioner Gordon a total just bastion of good, it's more boring. It makes for less interesting storytelling. Having him have the feet of clay definitely makes for a more interesting story.
Well, go ahead. I'm sorry.
My wife and I watch a bunch of different series. We've been binging a lot of them. And a lot of the ones we watch were the old soap operas, Dallas and Dynasty and things like that. And when you get to a part where somebody, you know, they get married in one episode, and then at the end of the season, they're having marital problems and one of them's cheating on the other, and she gets a little bothered by it. She's like, oh, why do they have to do this? And I tell her, well, if they don't do that, it's kind of boring. You just don't want to have, oh, they all just live happily ever after. They all have, you know, there has to be conflict or it's not interesting. So the feet of clay is what creates the conflict.
But
so I totally agree with you, but I just get selfish sometimes with my characters, especially the ones I see as
entitled, pivotal, my friend,
that I want entitled. Them to be, again, bastions of good.
But what I would say to that also, what I think Miller and Mazzucchelli do really well with that plot device, this book, is that Gordon is so well realized as a character, and Sergeant Essen is also so well delineated in terms of who she is, that you really believe that they've been put together in this extremely stressful situation. He's heading this campaign to try to find out who this vigilante is. He's surrounded by corrupt cops all around him, some of them who may even try to kill him at some point. And, you know, he's got this really capable police officer who's working with him, who is also gorgeous. And he's obviously drawn to her, and vice versa. So you really believe that they have a fling. Like you can understand why it happens, and where his wife, you know, she's kind of like in another world in their apartment, and she's pregnant, and she really has no, she's not in the world he's in.
And in this story, she's kind of a cipher. You're not really getting her personality in this. And I don't know where I read it or saw it, but there were other stories where she was shown to be kind of psychologically unbalanced, and I thought that kind of gave him the out of, okay,
well,
he was seeking support somewhere else.
Paul, if you really want to be demoralized, read the graphic novel Night Cries, where Jim Gordon has found out that he is so traumatized by being a police officer that he's actually been abusing his son. Remember that one, Sean?
Mm-hmm. that's vaguely familiar. I've definitely heard something about that.
I decided not to read that one.
Yeah, Sean, you can say something. I'm sorry.
No, it's actually more about Gordon. Keep in mind what Gordon was doing during this, though. Even how he arrives in Gotham, he does not arrive with his wife. No. He knows he's going to a bad place.
Yeah.
She can't be on the ground level like he is. She's got to fly in because she shouldn't. There's an immediate separation between
them. Well
done. The whole first, he's trying to protect her and shelter her, but in that process, she's no longer a partner. She is being this. She's this person that he's got to protect. He's trying to do the noble thing and keep shelter her from this very bad place that they're at because of what drove him to Gotham, where he's at. But he knows that. The difference with Essen and where you kind of get where this went. I'm not, just don't get me wrong, I'm not saying like you should be doing this, but in his case, This is now this person who is at his level and understands what he's going through because she's there.
She's in the foxhole.
His wife can't possibly understand that because he won't let her. And he thinks he's doing the right thing. He's keeping her away from this, even to the point where he's sitting there saying, "I hope she's not pregnant. I hope she's not pregnant."
Yeah,
because he doesn't want to bring a child into Gotham.
Yeah.
But it's all about keeping them away. That's not me justifying the behavior. Don't get me wrong.
No.
From a storytelling standpoint, and what he thinks is the right thing to do to protect his wife, he's actually destroying his marriage because she's no longer his partner. And can't be because he is committed to that course of action.
He knows it's his fault that all of this is happening. It's his doing that got them there. So and he's putting her on a pedestal and protecting her.
And to piggyback on your point, Sean, like in the second issue, when he goes to confront the deranged man who's holding the children hostage, and he's like, "I hope Barbara's not watching this," but then he says, "I know she is." Yeah. And then when he's doing target practice and he's, you know, saying how much I hate the gun, but he needs to get better at it. And he's fortifying himself to protect her. Or like when he takes one precious night off. It's the date April 9th in the panel, and she's giving him a massage and she's prepared dinner. And then the only other corrupt cop who's not corrupt, Merkel, is aide.
Oh, Merkel.
Who also appears in Dark Knight Returns, by the way. And we never see his face, just always in shadow, but it's Merkel. And Merkel says, "Oh, we need him," and he's got to go. Like Barbara, it's Barbara's wife's name, right?
Yep.
Yeah. She can't get a break. And there's no way that with the way this is going that they're going to make it.
Neither can he either. You know, she can't get a break, but he can't either, because he thinks he's going to be able to, they pull him back in.
Well, the panel I'm just looking at the panel above, where she's kneading his shoulders, and you see just the silhouette of Batman appearing for the first time running on a rooftop. Art is absolutely stunning. They've created like a blue, midnight blue sky.
Those Richmond Lewis colors really do come through in that panel.
Yeah, that is myth right there. And then we have what Sean was waxing rhapsodic about, his first combat action where nearly one kid gets killed, and he's like holding on to his leg while the kid is hitting him in the head with the kicks and the TV's falling. It is... Again, when Paul was talking about his storytelling ability, Mazzucchelli, I mean, he just takes you panel by panel, how difficult it is and how he's almost screws up the entire first action. Just tremendous storytelling.
And it's also, you start to see him develop his sense of right and wrong there too, because he will not let go of that kid's
life. No.
And to the point of...
They hit him in the head with the television too. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's because of the awkward position he's in, he left himself vulnerable. And I just thought it was such a great sequence where you can't plan for that if you haven't had those experiences. We see why the more experienced Batman will be better served to deal with those type of situations.
Absolutely. That's what kind of like what Shane was talking about before, that the more experienced Batman has the plans for everybody and you know, all the contingency. This is his first time on the street in the costume. What I also like though is, and I think this is what I think Nolan captured very well, is that Batman is a physically powerful man. Mm-hmm. Like he is not, I love Michael Keaton. Never believed for a minute he was Batman physically. This is a powerful man who you do not want to fudge with. The fact that he could take on three young hoodlums, even though he's inexperienced and he still defeats all of them. And I like Batman should be physically intimidating when you confront him. And I think they capture that here.
The closest I think Michael Keaton comes to that is in the very beginning when he lifts the hoodlum off the roof and he's dangling him. But
that was beyond great
that, you don't get it quite the same through the rest of that movie. And I love that movie.
Oh, I do too. Michael Keaton's a wonderful actor. I'm not in the camp that he should have been Batman. I'm just saying my preference for Batman is someone who can kick the
bejesus out
of
here.
That it's not enough that he's physically capable of doing that. That he needs to have the psychological edge, and that, you know, he learns that very early on, that he has to have something to kind of get in their heads a little bit, to give himself a little bit of an edge.
Sure.
You know, otherwise that he's not, you know, otherwise he's going to be biting off too much.
And Paul, perfect segue is that they start to establish the myth of Batman through Flass's frankly hilarious description of what he experienced. And the fact that Gordon is deliciously enjoying every moment of Flass's discomfort in that scene, but he's talking about how, like, you know, he's a creature and blades came out of his hands, mm-hmm. and just the way they, you know, is Batman human, right? Is he supernatural? Is he not? Is he more than just a man? And that's part of the whole mystique he's trying to create. And again, and this is one of my favorite scenes in the whole book, when you have all the fat cats of the city meeting in at I think it's, is it Falcone's mansion? Or maybe it's the mayor's. It's the mayor's. And, you know, it's all the oligarchs of Gotham, the people who, of course, are the spiders at the center of the web. And they're all discussing, it's great writing, you know, how they're all trying to handle the Batman situation, how it all affects their various financial interests and their ne'er-do-well activity. When he appears through the smoke after throwing the bomb in, and then he grabs the top of the plate to put extinguish the fire, then you're like, oh, now he's Batman. Like, mm-hmm. imagine the people in that room and how utterly terrified they must have been. It's that's when, for me, the story reaches the mythic level, and as it should in those moments.
You also see why he looks like a creature.
Yeah.
Because the cape defies shape. And I love that sequence because you can't pin down a body there. It's all because of the trickery, which that's the piece that I've always loved about that. And what was mentioned earlier by somebody on here, and I loved it, that Batman Begins owes so much to this one because of the fact that I think a lot of that theme of using illusion and all of that clearly came from stuff like this.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I thought there was an interesting artistic comparison when you see the shot in the story of him coming through the smoke, which basically mirrors the cover of that issue. Yeah. But the cover is much more simplistically drawn without the smoke so much. It almost looks like it's Batman Adventures, and it's going to be like it's going to be a kid's story. But then when it's in the story, it's extremely effective because of a lack of color and because of the smoke.
Well, you know, it reminds me of, we were mentioning before how the Nolan films borrow heavily from the story. Mm-hmm. One of my favorite scenes in Batman Begins is when Gordon goes to his office, the lights go off, and you just hear Batman's voice, and he puts the stapler to his neck, and then he says, "You're just one man." Then he goes, "Now we're two," and then he vanishes. Yeah. Like, those are the moments of that movie where I'm like, oh, they really got this. Like, that's what you need.
That's my favorite Nolan movie is Batman Begins.
Yeah, me too.
Oh, yeah.
But one of the things that I like about this story is it gives you the perspective of, it gives you the different perspectives of Batman. You have Bruce Wayne training and what he's going through. You have Gordon and his buildup and how Batman interacts with that and interweaves with that and his perception of Batman. And then you have the police and the general public's perception of him as almost this mythological, non-human creature. So there's three different perspectives that are being played out, but it's not done in a heavy-handed way where it's, okay, now we're going to cut to this one. Now we're going to cut to that one. It's all interwoven very, very
organically.
Cleverly. Yeah, organically. I think that's a great word for it. So that you're getting the different perspectives, but you never feel like you're being spoon-fed them.
Well, there's a well put, Paul. Like when I'm looking on the next page where Gordon's trying to trap him with, like, Essence playing like a woman being attacked by a mugger. And again, to go back to Sean's point about the cape, if you look at the lower corner, it's almost like he's kind of coming out of, like, the debris in the alley. As he just crouches, he just says, Gordon's wasting a lot of manpower on these traps. So right there, he's already the tactician who's seeing through, right, somebody else's gambit. What do we think about the next page? So Harvey Dent's introduced, but here we're nowhere near Two-Face, right? It is the upright, you know, the lone politician in town who's trying to actually, you know, follow the law and do the right thing, who's the district attorney. And I love how they sort of start that triumvirate, although Gordon doesn't realize it yet because Batman's hiding under Harvey's desk when Gordon goes in to interrogate him. But like that Gordon thinks, you know, is Harvey Dent Batman? And he shows the weights that he lifts up in his office. But what'd you guys think of that?
I just like introducing him that way, so we get a little bit of Harvey Dent well before he becomes Two-Face, that he really was with Gordon and Batman, the third person trying to save.
And I think it's important to give him a history before he becomes Two-Face.
Yeah.
You know, it's one of the things I was talking to somebody recently, and we were talking about these prequel TV shows, like when they did Gotham, and they have all of Batman's villains being introduced one by one while Bruce Wayne is 10 years old.
Yeah.
And it's like, no, that makes no sense. And if you're going to try and relate it to the stories,
it's impossible.
Yeah, I don't like it.
I enjoyed that show well enough, but I had that same problem. It drove me crazy that all these villains are established and Bruce Wayne's a kid yet.
They did. I mean, effectively, they did the same thing. As much as I enjoyed Smallville, they did the same thing where they started introducing different villains, and he's still technically not even Superman yet.
Yeah.
Well, Paul, they're self-contained universes.
Elseworlds.
Yeah. Well, they are. They are absolutely.
It's all Elseworlds. DC's already got that banner, and I had to relegate both of those shows to that in order to just kind of relax and enjoy them. They're just telling an Elseworlds story.
Yeah.
DC freed up a lot by creating that line.
Now, I think one of the most thrilling sequences in the whole story, ending with this issue going to issue 3, is he saves the old woman who's about to be run down by the truck. Gripping storytelling by Mazzucchelli. And then, of course, the SWAT team arrives, who are, you know, thoroughly corrupted. And then the battle in the old dilapidated tenement is just absolutely riveting. Again, Mazzucchelli's storytelling, you know, the cat and Batman being shot, I think twice actually during that. But I mean, like even the page where he's falling through the debris, there's the flames around, and you see some poor wino being consumed by fire, kind of off to the side. So you realize the cost of Loeb's corruption as he's trying to shut down this threat to his interests. Absolutely riveting storytelling.
Him in the tenement, you almost get a, you know, it's not as heavy-handed as all that, but you almost get a diehard feeling from it. You know, the one man against everybody.
Mm-hmm. Have any of you listened to DC High Volume, the audios
that they've released? Yet.
I have not.
So they're doing direct audio adaptations of the issues. So in the case of Batman Year One, it is issue 1, issue 2, issue 3, and issue 4. They're using the dialogue and the narrative straight from the comic.
And they have actors performing it?
Yes.
How is it?
So it's fantastic. Really? And what's a really cool thing to do, first of all, I recommend listening to it without looking at the comic the first time, just to enjoy the audio experience and everything that goes along with the performance.
All about that.
But if you pull this up with the book and listen to it, it is a whole different level of experience. As a kid, I was into the whole
book. Oh, it's like Power Records Returned.
It is absolutely that experience. And if anybody thinks I'm diminishing the experience by saying that, I am a junkie for Power Records and what was done with those pieces. I actually went and sought out the ones that I like beat up as a kid, and I own them because of the fact that those, like, they still resonate with me, especially the Grodd one and Batman and Sherlock Holmes. But this DC High Volume, they've done Long Halloween. Currently doing Dark Victory. They're kind of going in a sort of chronological order with Batman. But Year One, if you're listening to this and you're a fan of Year One, do yourself a favor and check it out, because they've got a high quality cast and it's well worth listening to.
I'll have to. I love full cast audio dramas. Absolutely love it.
That the scene we were just discussing, the battle in the tenement, again, the myth, when he summons the bats from the cave and the impact that has on, you know, the crowd and everyone. But again, the art is amazing, the way he depicts the bats just consuming almost like the sun, and then the crowd and the cars and he, you know, he's able to get away on the motorcycle. But again, to go back, I'm a broken record, but Mazzucchelli, I mean, very few artists, I think, can pull off both the grit and the grind, but also there's a mythic element to all of this, and it's masterfully done.
I love the line of, too bad I can't afford to patent this. And it's not a financial thing. It's all about the fact I've got to keep the secret.
Yep.
But I liked those little details of how I'm keeping the secret in place. That kind of thinking just, again, added a reality.
In fact, it reminds me, Sean, there's a moment in the book, I don't remember which issue, where they're talking about how Wayne Enterprises is like perfecting new plastics and new innovations that they can be applied to. And you know that obviously he's marshaling the sources of his father's company for his war on crime. Essentially, there's no Lucius Fox here. Like, this is just Bruce Wayne, essentially. Mm-hmm. So, when we get to they really go into the Gordon Essen relationship, because now they're working late nights, because there's tremendous pressure on him by the elites to bring this vigilante to justice. And the narrative of how you see him starting to really fall for her. And like what Sean was saying before, like she's at his level, they're in this trench together. Their scene when they go to the diner together to have a cup of coffee, Miller's writing is tremendous. It's absolutely tremendous in that scene. You really understand their relationship, the dynamic between them. Gordon, you see Gordon just falling. Like, you know, he this is a kindred spirit.
You also see him trying to fight the urge.
Yep.
Yes.
Yep. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So like, go ahead, Paul. I'm sorry.
No, I was just going to say, the only thing I was going to say was looking at the art on that is I'm trying to see who the character models are now. I'm thinking maybe Kim Basinger. I don't know.
Well, I'm looking at like, this is like classic noir writing here. So he's describing them in the doorway. Gotham weather, just when the rain seems to be clearing up, lightning flashes. And we learn how Noah felt, not having an ark. We settle for a doorway. Like it's he just has Hammett and Chandler like open, and he's just being inspired by those writers essentially. And I mean that as a total compliment. This is great stuff. And look at the splash page of him on the bed, cradling his service revolver, his wife very pregnant, and you just see the weight of the world on his sagging shoulders. And you know, the hunk of metal in my hands is heavier than ever. Because he realizes really, that. Go ahead, Shane.
He's really debating what to do. He's supposed to bring in this vigilante, but he saved that woman.
He saved the woman. He saved knows. The cat.
Yeah, he knows.
Adam, you had something to add?
I was talking about that scene between Gordon and Essen in the diner. The Mazzucchelli trying to class things up a bit by throwing in a reference to the American artist Edward Hopper. Diner is called Hopper's, after all, and that scene is taken right out of Hopper's painting Nighthawks, which has been the wallpaper on my laptop for the last 10 years. He's
well done.
Probably my favorite American fine artist.
Yeah,
tremendous artist. Look, the scene where, like, to go back, I'm glad Murd pointed that out, when he's lighting her cigarette and the look on her face, I mean, she wants him. And it's great. It's very expressive artwork, but he just does it with just a couple lines beneath of ink lines beneath her eyes and the look in her face. Master artist. This is
the great cartoonists can say volumes, just a couple little blots of ink.
Indeed. All right, so we're moving into the fourth and final chapter here, gentlemen. go ahead, Paul. I'm sorry.
No, I'm just I'm marveling at your marveling at the book.
I just the stuff that has this kind of impact on me, you know, my whole life, I just can't help but gush. I mean, it's just part of my MO, I suppose. But the little touches. So when Batman is scaling a brick wall, grabbing into the crevices in between the bricks. Just to emphasize how powerful this man is.
Wouldn't it be cool if Ted Cassidy came out of one of the windows and looked down and started talking to him?
Maybe Sammy Davis Jr.
Dick Clark went too once, right?
But again, we talked about the use of colors. So the what's the pimp character's name?
Skeevers, I think.
Skeevers. So his room has like this red light bulb, right? Bordello type feel to it. The way the lawyer talks to him, you are right in the slime now. This is the utter world of Gotham corruption. but I'm fine with Batman crouching. And again, imagine being Skeevers and this creature is now on top of you. And to go back to what you guys were saying, you know, is it a man? Is it something else? I mean, if you're that terrified, man.
Now, one of the things I'm going to marvel about in the artwork is Mazzucchelli's drawing of Batman on his glider. Because it looks to me like it would work. And that's saying something. I love those shots.
One of my favorite sequences in the whole story is when Jim and Barbara go to Wayne Manor. And first of all, he describes the butler as making them feel as welcome as a virus, which is a great line. And this is where we first get the Bruce Wayne mask that Batman wears to the outside world. And here he is, the drinking alcohol early in the morning in his night robe with some strumpet next to him. And it's that persona that, you know, he's creating a role. Remember, Batman is also a great actor. Or Bruce Wayne is a great actor, and you know, he's presenting this, and you know, Barbara finds him to be a pig. I think one of the best scenes actually in the animated movie that we'll talk about at the end, because they added something to the scene where he actually crosses his legs so she sees his private parts to show what a pig he is. Yeah. It's just a great touch to further emphasize this role that he's playing, essentially. What you guys think of the scene?
It's a great effect in Batman Begins, too, with the, you know, putting the Bruce Wayne as the mask.
Oh, Bale, I thought Bale was tremendous as like the
playboy,
the dissolute Bruce Wayne. Like the scene where he's in the restaurant with the fountain and the two women.
Exactly.
That scene, I was like giddy.
In that scene, as soon as what's her name shows up in the movie, he's completely different.
Oh yeah,
well, and almost embarrassed by it.
Yeah,
because he's letting his guard down for her.
Yeah, he's not playing. Not playing that persona anymore. Yeah. But when Jim and Barbara leave, and she's talking about, you know, what a pig he is, and that scene, what I love about it is they don't show you their conversation. You don't need to see their conversation. It's Bruce wondering, okay, why has the car been sitting there for 10 minutes?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you can imagine what's going on in the car between the two of them as he reveals to his wife that he's been having this torrid affair. It's great storytelling. They're not giving you too much. They're not going to take you through some melodramatic multi-panel scene of him confessing to her. You don't need to see that. You can just imagine it, and it's really powerful. So,
well, yeah, especially when you get to the next page and you see that she has to relive it often.
Well, because the press is calling and they're trying to use it to blackmail him.
Yep.
And with the phone, when she's on the phone and him in the corner, you see they kind of cast him like in a black red type of sheen, and it, just the look of, and I mean, anyone who's ever had, you know, we if you're in a serious relationship and there's a tough period you're going through. Hopefully nothing like that, but you know, everybody experiences, you know, tumultuous times, and you know, the weight that takes on puts on your life and how it consumes everything, it makes other things in life difficult to deal with or to move through and navigate. You really feel for Barbara. Like it's you imagine she probably has no friends. Can she even get out that much? She's in an extremely dangerous city that her husband has brought her to. He's never home. She's immensely pregnant. I mean, it's, man, it's good stuff. So what do we think about the introduction of Catwoman? That she puts the costume on.
That's great.
I'm not sure, frankly.
Okay.
Because I don't want to interweave her origin with his so much. And that was one of the things, like when we talked about Gotham before, like everything was connected and it got to be when everything's connected, it makes the world too small. So I like some things to just happen independently of each other. So I like seeing her in the costume. I like the introduction, but I also would have liked it to be a little bit more independent of the story that was going on, if that makes any sense to you guys.
Sure. Sean, what'd you think?
I really like this Catwoman. what I like about her on this one is this idea of she's trying to find her place in this world as well, and does not like him like almost getting her press. Yep. And has some real issues with it, to the point where Holly's even telling her, like, hey, this is a good thing. Nobody knows it was you. Mm. But she's like wants to go back and like scratch the face of the Roman and stuff
sign
like that.
Her work a little more emphatically.
Yeah. She wants you to know. I like the initial costume. I love her later costumes, how her suit evolves and becomes much more functional. But I liked the early style of this where it was a lot more, you know, it's got whiskers and all the other pieces. I wouldn't want her to keep this. But I felt like, you know, like similar to early versions of Batman's suit that have been a little bit more, a little less sleek, a little less armored. Mm. I like that she had to adapt over time. Mm. I've liked her various origins. So, you know, like Paul, I love ones that are a little bit more disconnected, you know, where they meet later on. But for this particular one, especially with her early parts with Holly, I liked the early parts with Holly so much that by now she's kind of interwoven because of what they did with Holly early on. I'm a Batman junkie, so I like the various versions of her. I like the whole long skirt in the past and all that kind of stuff too that she used to go as well.
Do you even like the Bronze Age, like the blue one with the shoulder?
Yes. Yeah. I geek out when they do all these characters do their trophy cases and stuff like that. And it's the stuff like I read that. And it doesn't take much for me. You give me a little bit of nostalgia in the background and I'm good to go.
The panel where he's basically saved her. And then she scratches the Roman's face. But notice at the top panel, you just see the top of the cape like wings. Mm-hmm. Just for an instance, she never actually even sees him. It adds to that mythic, supernatural quality to the character. And by the way, let's talk a bit about Alfred, because right away they establish Alfred is really not happy that the man he's basically raised as his own son, for all intents and purposes, is going out and pursuing this campaign. Like when he's reading the newspaper, he's quoting marked increase in paranoia. You always love that Alfred is loyal, but he's never really that enthusiastic, and he's always concerned about, because, you know, let's face it, obviously what Bruce is doing is insane. Mm. So,
yeah.
But, you know, he'll be with him to the end.
That's something I appreciate about one of the scenes of Ben Affleck when he's Batman says to Alfred, and Alfred says to him, he's like, well, we're criminals. We've always been criminals. We know that. He knows it.
Yeah, and I really wanted to see more of that Ben Affleck Batman, honestly.
Me too. And the interaction with what's his name is Alfred.
Oh, Jeremy Irons.
Jeremy Irons.
Oh yeah. I don't think there's ever been a bad Alfred.
No.
No, I don't think I agree with that, Paul. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think though, to play it right in my mind, Alfred has to be a reluctant associate. Yeah. Like if he's like encouraging Bruce to do this, then you say, what's wrong with this guy? He's supposed to love this. Yeah. You know, this is like his son. Yeah. But if he has the knowledge that this is going to happen, whether he helps or not, and by helping, he makes it more likely that Bruce is going to survive and be successful in his mission, then it makes it seem more fatherly.
Mm-hmm. Of course.
I 99.9% of the time agree with you, except for the Batman 66 Alfred. He needs to be their one that is covering for them. he was completely complicit. He was, you know, basically
was he ever
all in checking?
Was there an episode where he dressed up as Batman?
The only time
there was,
That one I'll take. But otherwise 99.9% of the time, I'm 100% in your corner for that. But, that Alfred, like he's got to keep behaving that way.
But I do marvel at the fact that all of the theatrical
versions and he also
of
keeps,
Batman, I've
keeps
always Batgirl enjoyed Alfred. Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, was he always supposed to know Batgirl's secret, or were there times where he just kind of knew it kept it to himself?
We're talking about Jim Gordon?
Alfred 66.
Oh, Alfred.
Oh, yeah. Alfred knew it from the first episode she was on. Mm-hmm. He discovered it then and kept it secret the entire time.
But Bruce didn't know it.
No.
Right.
That's okay.
So the world's greatest detective figured that out.
I find it amazing that you could interact with, you know, the Adam West Bruce Wayne and the Adam West Batman and not know it's the same person.
Yeah.
I find that just to be, it just adds to the comic element of that series.
What's not comic is the way this story ends.
Yeah.
This closing action scene is about as good as it gets, ladies and gentlemen. First of all, do you think Disney would approve today if they put Mickey Mouse as a phone being used by a corrupt police commissioner?
No.
Panel?
No.
It's okay. I canceled my Disney Plus for political reasons anyway. But anyway, this scene, what did you guys think of this? I think this is so gripping, the drama of this, when Gordon is trying to save his son.
Yeah, it's terrifying. To me, it's absolutely terrifying.
Well, you as Uber father, I can only imagine. But again, the myth, because when Gordon, you know, Gordon's training takes over and he says, I got to shoot them because they're going to kill my kid. So he knows he has to. So he engages. And then he thinks Bruce is like a follow-up assassin.
Yep.
And he shoots him. And when he takes the helmet off, Mrs. Gordon, you have to trust me. I won't let your boy die. And you assuming that she can't really see his face, like they have it in shadow, because she's seen Bruce Wayne in person. Mm-hmm. But that moment for me is one of the most powerful of the whole book in that, you know, she's a mother, her child's been abducted, she has the gun, and then she just lets him go because she innately knows this guy is going to do everything he possibly can.
Yeah.
The power of that scene is also underlined by the expert way it's choreographed by Mazzucchelli.
That's again his storytelling, Paul. Like you said before, like it the way he captures Gordon opening fire, you know, him being hit in the shoulder, the car running. I mean, it's sequential story. Like they're a comic artist. Like they'll draw a great panel, they'll draw a great pinup. They can't do this as well, though. I mean, this is a lot of artists can draw do a great rendering of a character, but to tell a story with the level of drama he's doing here. This is elite stuff, and we've all read thousands and thousands of comic books. Very few come to this level, as far as I'm concerned. And go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was going to say the choice to have Bruce completely out of costume in this, just because of the nature of the daytime and all of that piece. Well, I thought that was so solid from this, and I love that Bruce is at this point. You know, before he was so focused on keeping the identity with the scar. There's a child's life at risk here. He's getting on a 10 speed at once. There's no focus on like covering up his face or anything. He is with Barbara, he was in the shadows and all that, but I don't know that he would have done anything differently, except in that moment, he's got to comfort this woman. He's going to go take care of the kid. And I just loved everything about the heroic moment of that. You have to make a decision there. Jim had to make a decision.
Yep.
You have to make a decision in those pivotal moments. Are you going to take action to save? And Jim, it was to save his wife and to save his child. For Bruce, it's I've got to go and save this child. What is more important? I loved the urgency of that moment and the fact that everyone's willing to put themselves at risk to do what they believe is right, knowing that there is such danger to that choice.
Yeah.
And there's a possibility that you might not save this kid.
And to emphasize that last point, Sean, when she's running to the railing, and notice how Mazzucchelli has devotes three panels to her progression, and you feel her terror and her panic, and then they finally give you the crying, and then you know the baby has survived. And I love how Gordon, even in a moment this traumatic and emotional, he's still. The detective, he goes, you must be wearing some armor under that jacket. Mm-hmm. And he just goes, yes. And obviously he knows it's Batman. But their partnership is forged right there because he just saved his son. And now Jim knows that I can trust this guy all the way.
Yep.
And the closing button on this is not identical, but eerily similar to the end of Batman Begins with the touch of the Joker is coming.
Absolutely. I mean, and it's great narration by Gordon. And you see, like, and what's interesting, the way Mazzucchelli draws Gordon, like, he fills out his face a little bit. He's got the signature pipe now, you know, the trench coat. And like, oh, he's commissioner. I mean, he's not a commissioner yet, but he's Commissioner Gordon now. And he seems almost a little bit older in a way. Like, he's kind of gone through this baptism of fire. And now he's come out the other end. And he's more the character we're going to come to know and love than all these adventures.
See, I took it a lot as he knows he's not alone now.
Absolutely.
He's not fighting the one-man war against corruption anymore. He's got at least one solid ally, even though the world at large doesn't necessarily agree with him.
And that last image you see, that is one of my favorite images of Batman.
Yep.
Yes. And for anybody listening, that's the inside back cover of the trade with just a tremendous picture of Batman.
I've had that as a button. I use it on Facebook at times.
I had it as a shirt when I was in middle school.
Oh, nice.
That's cool.
It didn't exist when I was in middle school, but that's besides the point.
Do any of you have the Absolute edition of this?
No. I do not.
I do. The cool thing about the Absolute edition in this one is volume one is modern printing, where it's got all four issues in a modern print style. But because it's only four issues, volume two is the original in the newsstand version.
Ooh.
Oh, wow.
Where it's got the original covers, you know, in the way they would have been printed for the news in an oversized volume, but the original paper style, you know, the coloring is dealing with the limitations of the paper printing at the time. Mm. So you get both versions of it. It's really cool. For this, I ended up reading through both just to enjoy the experience.
Oh, what a beast that must have been.
That way. I'll be honest with you, it's the first time I ever looked at it. I'm like, so what is in the second volume of this thing? I'm like, what? This is in here? I didn't know. I was like paging through. So if you've got this and you never looked at the second volume, you really should. It's pretty cool. And it's a neat extra to be able to go through and actually see the original issues in that capacity. And there was never an opportunity to see the original issues that way.
Yeah.
Well, another route to take, and Shane would appreciate this, because I know he loves facsimiles. Mm-hmm. Recently, they published all four issues, I think month to month to month, it was within the last year. I saw them on the stands of facsimiles of the original four issues. So you get the original ads, the covers, and all that. So you can probably still find those in a comic shop. Somebody wants to get
that experience. I have to say, the first time I read this, it was 1987. I did not read it off the newsstand as it came out. I had started reading Justice League and Batman Monthly and gone backwards to get these issues and then read it. And then 1988 comes around. I'm turning 16. And my dad goes to a farmer's market in Quakertown goes to a comic shop and picks up this hardback volume just because he knows I like Batman and I'm into comics, and gives it to me separate from my mom or any other goings on for my birthday. Says, hold on a second, I got something for you. Goes around the corner into the bedroom, pulls out this wrapped up and gives it to me as a birthday present, just him and me. So that's what I read this time to get ready for this.
Dear old dad.
So this is almost 40 years old.
That's awesome.
Absolutely love that version.
Now, speaking of versions, let's talk about the animated adaptation they did. What year was that? 2011?
That's right.
Okay. I watched it again last week. I hadn't watched it since 2011, actually. So what do we all think of that now that we've all read the original?
It's a far cry from
the original. It's a fantastic job.
Wait, we got two.
Yeah.
Murray, go ahead.
Yeah, it's a pretty diluted version of the real story. I mean, I mentioned earlier that it feels awfully stripped down and stripped out, lacking, you know, Miller's narrative voice. Of course, a lot of it survives, but much of it is stripped out, and I miss it. The animation style, it reminds me an awful lot of what was used for the Boondocks cartoon for Adult Swim. It's entirely possible it came through the same studio. It was very, I will say, it's quite faithful in terms of plot. to what was done in the original. It's almost shot for shot, although certain liberties were taken, certain things were changed here and there, things added, things omitted. Like, for example, Sean mentioned when the unmasked Batman grabs some lady's 10-speed and takes off in pursuit of the kidnappers. Instead, the animators decided to have him do, like, parkour leaps up to a rooftop and then somehow run faster than a tractor trailer for a block or two and then leap down onto the... Just have him stealing the bike, damn it. It's less ridiculous than what you're having him doing here. Yeah, my gosh. But,
yeah. Well, maybe they were playing with the parkour at the beginning of Casino Royale. Maybe that gave him the incentive there. I don't disagree with you, Adam. I do see where it's giving you the broad strokes of this 4-issue story, but it's not giving you the subtleties of the narration and the voice that you're getting from Miller. But see, I being a tad older than you guys, I grew up in an era where, like, you know, there were no VCRs until I was, or they weren't widely spread until I was in my late teens. So when I was a kid, a lot of times, you know, if there was a movie that you loved or a story that you loved, you know, you'd get like a Viewmaster version of it, which was, you know, 15 panels with a little dialogue on them. And that had to remind you of the whole story. So for me, the diluted version of this, you know, in a 1 hour or 1.5 hour, whatever it was, animated version, is still pretty inclusive compared to what I was used to as a kid. I think you're selling yourself short if you see the animated version and think, okay, I know the story, I'm good.
Oh yeah, you got to read.
But if you've read the story and then you're using the animated version as a companion to it or a reminder of it, I think it's perfectly serviceable in that way.
Serviceable is a good.
So here's what I like about it. Why I say I thought it was great. At this time, DC animation was changing the style of animation, which I was not thrilled with. The voice actors are radically different. Kevin Conroy's not doing everything. I miss the earlier versions of stories that they were telling animation-wise. This was one of the better ones that they put out. So to me, this is a fairly faithful adaptation. You're right, it doesn't give you a lot of the subtleties, but it was better than the direction they were going in almost every other way at that time. And they then had since set... then...
Sorry.
Go ahead. No, go ahead.
No, I was going to say they had a set runtime for these, and that was one of the limitations. Yeah.
An hour and a half or less an hour.
It's good. Yeah, so, I mean, that took away from some of the pieces that we would have liked to have seen in it, but I felt like for what the runtime that they had, they did a great job. But I'm sorry, yeah. I didn't mean to cut you off.
No. But that's why I thought this was one of the better ones that they were doing at that time. And since then, in a lot of ways, a lot of their animation has gotten worse. There's some really good stuff like Young Justice, the episodic, fantastic. But a lot of their animated features really just don't live up to what they used to be in my mind. And this was one of the last really good ones that I think they did.
I think you guys made a valid point in that. I think this is a good companion to the book. Like if you read the book and you love the book, definitely check it out. I think for me, I have mixed feelings about it. First of all, Cranston is perfect choice to play Gordon. That was my favorite part of the whole experience, that he's playing Jim Gordon. The actor doing Batman, he's the guy who played Jim Gordon in Gotham, right? Isn't that him?
I think so.
McKenzie, I think the name was. I believed him as Bruce Wayne was during that scene we were talking about when he was playing the Bruce Wayne cad.
Nerd, you beat me to the punch, my friend. I was not impressed with his performance, and that's, I think, one of the things about the production that I found a little weak. I was not thrilled with him just in general, his voice performance, except in that scene where he was perfect, Murd. I couldn't agree more. The other thing that I was kind of mixed on, whenever creators adapt something into another medium, they can either try to do a completely faithful adaptation or they try to kind of put their own spin on it and mix it up. I found in this, what struck me was they were trying to recreate what was in the book, but because like Sean said, they had a time limitation. So it was in some ways kind of like a flat version of what you read in the book. And I think some of Gordon's narration that is so powerful and pulpy in the comic didn't necessarily translate well sometimes in the animated version. sometimes I think when you try to adapt something so faithfully to the point, you make kind of wring out some of the life out of it a little bit. Like, for example, I mentioned when they added a scene where he lifts his leg to show his private parts to Barbara, so he's playing the Cadmore. That was great. Like, I love that they put their own little twist into that scene. I would have liked a little bit more of that, actually, because and Sean, that's a great point, I didn't think of it, but the time limitation, as I think about it, really had an impact on what they were trying to do. But again, I still think it's worth seeing. For Cranston alone, it's worth watching it.
And I think that the animated version really showcases Gordon more than Batman.
Absolutely. And it has to, because you just hired Bryan Cranston to do it, so you better give him time. So
I've watched all these DC animated releases as they come out. I agree with Shane. This is one of the better ones. I wish in 2011 they hadn't started yet taking the risk of doing a multi-parter. They did it on some of the later ones, and this one would have benefited greatly from doing a two-parter. Where you could, I wish this had been the first one where they dipped their toe in, just because I enjoyed what I got. It would have been great to flesh everything out and have it all in there and just let's embrace the cast that we've got and really like dive into this bad boy and do that.
And even would have Dark Knight Returns being a two-parter, that did help that.
Yep.
Yes.
There is a certain dynamic between, and it's more often between prose novels, just because it's more common, when they try to put them to a moving picture, whether it's animated or live action, that usually they have to pare it down somewhat. And if you've read the novel, more often than not, you walk away saying the novel was better than the movie.
Oh, yeah.
There's very, very few. The two that jump out at me are two of my favorite movies of all time, Jaws and The Godfather.
I knew I would say the same thing.
Actually better than the books.
I'd add Jurassic Park to that list.
I'm sorry?
I'd add Jurassic Park to that list.
Oh, yeah. You know something? I read Jurassic Park first, and the first time I saw the movie, I was actually a little disappointed because there was so much. When I read the book, my imagination was going wild,
and there were so many different things that they did. People died in the book, survived in the movie, and vice versa.
I have grown to truly love the movie.
Yeah.
The first time I saw it, I was actually a little disappointed in comparison to the book, because the book just had me. Like, it was a page turner for me, to be honest with you. I was all over that book.
Yeah,
I certainly respect that you feel differently. That's fine. But for, I think 9 times out of 10, if you've read the book, you're going to say the book is better than the movie.
You know, Paul, just coincidentally, I just finally, Jaws is one of my top 10 films easily. And our dear friend, Danielle Corsetto, that's like her favorite novel. And I finally, we were chatting. I said, all right, I'm going to read it. So I went out and bought a 50th anniversary copy. I'd never read the novel before. And it's a great, and I really enjoyed the novel, but it's a great example of how, I was talking about this before when it came to how they did Year One. Sometimes I like it when a creator takes the essence of like the novel and they do really a very different story, because Steven Spielberg's Jaws is very different from the Jaws. And the Jaws novel is really about the politics of that town, and none of the characters are that likable. It's a much darker story. And then Spielberg just made it a Spielberg movie and focused more on the hunt for the shark. And the movie's amazing. I think it's a perfect film, but it's an example of how, and The Godfather too, like The Godfather, I've read The Godfather. It's a good book, but the movie's Shakespeare essentially. I mean, it's a totally, it just elevates it to a whole nother level. And Spielberg just took the idea of Jaws and he just did something very different and immensely entertaining with it. So
we talked, just to tie it together, we talked a little bit about film noir. The book, The Godfather, is almost film noir, whereas the movie is an epic.
Yeah.
No, and I think that's the difference. There's a difference in tone that just makes that movie. Well, for me personally, it's the greatest movie of all time. My number one movie of all time is The
Godfather. Actually, and I know this is a whole different discussion. I actually revere the second movie more than the first one.
I go back and forth on that, and I consider them to be one movie because I as a teenager, I got totally wrapped up in The Godfather, the complete saga, where they
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I know that.
And to put them together. So yeah. I kind of treat them in my mind as the same, but I actually like The Godfather Part Two, and I know we're far afield here, but I like The Godfather Part Two because of the way they do the comparison of Vito Corleone as a young man to Michael Corleone as a young man, or as a man who's growing into his power and how he handles it and how family is so important to Vito, and it becomes almost lost to Michael. And I shouldn't get so far into The Godfather here, but
not that, but
I do love those movies.
I'll say just one last comment because you got me going here is that I think Al Pacino's performance in Godfather 2 is one of the greatest performances in the history of film.
Yeah, I do not bow at the altar of Al Pacino. I don't think he is a great actor, but in The Godfather, The Godfather Part 2, and Dog Day Afternoon, I think his performances are almost unparalleled. He is amazing in those.
Look what Sean did with his Designated.
So for those of you listening, Sean just changed his name to Carmine the Godfather Falcone.
Just bringing it all back.
I mean, we could go on and on and debate Al Pacino's performances.
I will come on your movie
podcast. Adam looked like he was almost ready to faint when I said he wasn't a great actor.
No, Pacino's a great actor. We differ there.
Yeah, well, like I said, I think in those three performances, he's as good as can be. But I've seen him ham it up on too many movies for me to.
Well, even Brando had some clunkers. I mean, you know, that's.
I always point to this certain actors who they've been in bad movies, but I don't think they've ever given a bad performance. And the three that come to mind off the top of my head are Gene Hackman. Robert Duvall.
Duvall is one of my favorites.
And too. Michael Caine. I think they've all been in bad movies.
Michael Caine has been in Jaws 4, and he made it.
Give a bad performance even then. He was still fun in that movie.
It was wonderful. He probably paid for a summer house with that movie.
That's what he says. but those are three actors I don't think have ever given bad performances.
One of my favorite Michael Caine movies is Death Trap with Christopher
Reeve. Oh, I love it. So much fun. Listen to our episode of Jaws on that.
All right, we'll come on your movie podcast. We'll talk about all this stuff.
Yeah, well, we did do Death Trap not that long ago, and we all pretty much enjoyed that one very, very much. So if you haven't already, seek it out.
Have you guys done French Connection?
Yes, we did.
Okay.
I think it speaks to the forgettability of the animated Batman Year One that we've gotten this far off topic.
Well, it is. I mean, to bring it back to that, it is forgettable after the conversation about the book, because everything that's in that animated film is in the book. Everything that's worthwhile is in there, plus more.
Plus more, exactly.
So that's why I say it works as a companion to the book. It should not be a standalone viewing.
Yeah. I agree.
Whew. So does anybody have any closing thoughts on this before we wrap this up?
I think, like Chris said earlier, it's essential reading is Batman Year One. It's pinnacle to Batman storytelling.
Yeah, we were discussing it before we started to record. I think just Chris and Sean and I were on, and I was saying, you know, I think in my mind, I was thinking people think of this as like one of the stories. You know, that, you know, people say, oh, Watchmen is this and this, you know, whichever one they point to. And I thought that we were going to go into this conversation that I was going to be almost the naysayer saying, yeah, it's really good, but I don't know if it's at that level. But the more we talk about the more I agree with everything everybody was saying. I mean, I do think this is a top-notch story. I think the place where I was a little lost for direction on it was because I felt more that it was more of a Jim Gordon story than a Bruce Wayne story. But just the same, I think it's great. And Al Pacino does not like me at all, Sean.
Paul, I want to thank you for having us on. This is a real treat to be able to talk about this.
Yeah. It was great to be on with you guys.
It's always a treat to get you guys on, and I don't think we've had a bummer of a conversation yet. I think every time you guys have been on, it gets hit out of the park, and I appreciate what you guys bring to the table, and I thank you for it on behalf of myself and all the listeners.
We're honored, my friend. Thank you.
Yeah. Always a good time, Paul.
Yep.
So thanks again for coming on, guys, and thank you, everybody, for listening, and we'll see you next time. Bye-bye.
Thank you so much for listening to our show, and we hope you'll continue to join us each and every week for more good old-fashioned comic book back issue awesomeness. You can contact Back to the Bins to leave feedback, comments, questions, suggestions, and criticisms via email at bins@twotruefreaks.com or by joining the Back to the Bins group on Facebook. Back to the Bins is a proud affiliate of the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Network, which you may find at www.twotruefreaks.com. Two True Freaks is a registered trademark of DiMonzo Corp of Milan, Italy. All rights reserved. Please take a moment to stop by the twotruefreaks.com site and check out their many other fine podcasts, won't you? Thanks, and we'll see you next week.